Well, I'd like to thank, first of all, Marcus Epstein for inviting me and for organizing this meeting, especially in the face of certain difficult circumstances that he just described. I'd like to thank Mr. Martin and Mr. Derbyshire for agreeing to come, and I'd like to thank all of you for being here as well. I think the question before us is whether and to what extent conservatives should talk about race. Well, I think everybody should talk about race. Race is a central part of the American landscape, and there are so many things that we can't understand if we refuse to talk about race. I think at the same time, knowledge is always better than ignorance, and the truth is always better than deception. The fact that we cannot talk about race, frankly, in the society leads to various curious situations, and I'll give you an example of one. This may appear roundabout, but I will get to the point shortly. Imagine an airline which is known, compared to the industry average, to have, say, three or four times the rate of fatal accidents, to have three times the industry average of late departures, to lose your baggage four times more often than other carriers. If this information were well known, we would think twice about buying a ticket on this airline. In fact, such an airline might well go out of business. This is the kind of analysis we make every day of our lives. We weigh the advantages, we weigh the benefits, and we make a decision. When it comes to race or ethnicity, however, this kind of decision-making is essentially taboo. Let us imagine that there is a group of people who wish to come to our country in large numbers and live among us, whereas those who have already come here, we find that compared to the majority white population, they are four times more likely to commit murder. They're three times more likely to drop out of high school, twice as likely to have tuberculosis, have twice the illegitimacy rate. Now, if there were such a group, as I say, wishing to come in large numbers to the United States, you would think that this kind of data would be relevant to whether that's a good idea. I'm speaking of Hispanics, of course. You would think that this kind of analysis, the kind we make with respect to airlines or automobiles or anything else, would be legitimate. And yet, of course, it is not. We're not allowed to engage in this kind of discussion when it comes to immigration policy. Now, there are really two important aspects of race that remain silenced in the United States today. And I would call them, one is the scientific aspect, and the other is the sociological aspect. The scientific aspect has to do with racial differences in average intelligence. Now, everybody, and I mean everybody, who is not deliberately blind to the evidence, recognizes that on average, people of different races are not equally intelligent. Just to sum briefly, the average white IQ, as you all probably know, is about 100. The average black IQ in the United States is about 85. Hispanic, it's a little bit difficult because it's such a heterogeneous population, hard to get a pinpoint figure, but somewhere in the range of 88 to 90. And then Asians from North Asia, Koreans, Japanese, Taiwanese, Chinese, they come in at the top at about 103 to 105. These things explain a great deal. They explain a great deal that is otherwise inexplicable. Now, let me give you an example. For decades now, certainly since the 1960s, Americans have been wringing their hands over the fact that blacks, and now increasingly Hispanics, in school do not achieve the same level as whites and Asians. And every so often they get together and hold conferences to discuss this terrible blight on our national honor. No one seems to have figured it out. There is not one school district of thousands in this country in which you get the different groups to perform at the same level. And it is always blacks and Asians far behind, I'm sorry, blacks and Hispanics far behind whites and Asians. Well, a few years ago, as some of you probably know, we solved the problem. We passed a law, Congress passed a law, that says all groups will achieve at the same level. This is called the No Child Left Behind Act, as you know. Well, this is a little bit like King Canute telling the tide not to come in. And as you probably know, the way this works is that schools are judged not on their overall performance, but by the performance of each separate racial group. So, you may have a perfectly good high school in which everyone is doing fine, everyone's doing above average for the nation, in fact, except that the 15% that are black or Hispanic are not performing, they've not improved the way they should, and so the entire school is considered inadequate, needs to improve, and there can be sanctions. Well, people are now discovering that all the schools around the country are going to need sanctions of this kind. But they can take some comfort in the fact that because they are not alone, these sanctions will of course be waived. There will be exceptions made here and exceptions made there. And the whole business of legislating equality of outcome will come to naught. This is the kind of silliness we end up with because we are unwilling to recognize that the races are not perfectly, geometrically, mathematically, down to the tenth decimal point equal in every respect. Now, there are other consequences of insisting that every group is equal in every way. And that is, one, that's a very important one. It is that our society, in very important fundamental ways, is thereby teaching blacks, and increasingly teaching Hispanics as well, to hate whites. How does this work? It works like this. Our society has been telling all minority groups, yes, you are just as smart and hardworking as white people. And yet you do not achieve at the same level. You're more likely to be in jail, more likely to be poor. Why is that? A very simple explanation. See those people over there? Those white people? They are oppressing you. They have been oppressing you for centuries. And that, of course, is why you're not achieving at the same rate. Of course, that is the only explanation that's left if realistic talk about race is banished in the United States, which it has been banished. I think that this kind of hatred for whites is certainly clear in interracial violent crime rates, in the kind of anti-white rap lyrics that we can hear. In fact, I think that if it were not for the fact that many blacks, I mean, for heaven's sake, they're not stupid. I think they realize that the races are not, in fact, equal. Many of them do not realize that they're not equal. And if it were not for that realization, the hostility boiling against whites would be considerably greater than it is. And the fact is, if the United States has a real problem of visceral racial animus, it is a problem of blacks resenting and hating whites rather than the other way around. I wouldn't say that whites love blacks. I think most whites are more or less indifferent to blacks. But you don't have the kind of raging hostility that, in some cases at any rate, blacks feel towards whites. The notion, though, that essentially by legislating equality, which is what we have chosen to do, it's as futile and as stupid as deciding that Mexicans from henceforth are going to dominate professional basketball. But this is what it leads to if we refuse to take race seriously. There's, of course, another aspect to refusing to recognize that differences in outcome may have some source other than white wickedness. And that is, to the extent that whites themselves believe this, to the extent that whites believe that, yes, we and our ancestors are, in fact, responsible for black or Hispanic illegitimacy rates, crime rates, we did this, that burdens them with a sense of guilt that they do not deserve, and it makes impossible for whites as a group to advance their own legitimate interests. And this is a very dangerous state to be in a nation, in a world, in which every other group is prepared to advance its interests without compunction, often at the expense of whites. Now, I've met any number of people who will say, all right, okay, the evidence is overwhelming. It's true. There is considerable overlap, but on the average, blacks and whites simply will not perform at the same level, but we must never talk about this openly. We must never talk about it openly because it would be so depressing for black people for this to be common knowledge. They would be plunged into hopelessness, as we like to say. They would shoot each other. They would take drugs and get each other pregnant, etc., etc. Well, the fact is, compared to 60 or 70 years ago, in which it was commonly assumed that the races were not equal, blacks in that respect were much better off, much less likely to be doing the sorts of things that this hopelessness and depression that the facts about IQ would allegedly plunge them into. Furthermore, I think we do blacks a terrible disservice, and by the same token, Hispanics, the same terrible disservice, by in effect telling them that they're never allowed to grow up. One of the important aspects of growing up is the realization that you are not the best looking, the most athletic, the most musical, the most successful of the opposite sex, and that if somebody does better than you, it's not because you were cheated, that you are bested in a fair competition. That's an essential aspect of becoming a grown-up human being, to realize that you're not always going to win, that you're not always been cheated if somebody did better than you. We, of course, are saying to blacks collectively, you've been cheated. That's why you are not going to MIT. That's why you're not head of a Fortune 500, because white people have cheated you. We're, in effect, telling black people, and Hispanics as well, you're not allowed to grow up. This is a terrible disservice to them. Finally, this whole question of IQ that people refuse to talk about is correlated with all manner of social outcomes, some of them desirable, some of them undesirable. And I think, as you all know, high IQ is associated with desirable outcomes and low IQ with undesirable outcomes. We're now, of course, in the midst of a huge debate, a continuing debate on immigration. People from all around the world want to come to the United States, just as they want to come to all the European-derived nations. And we claim to be fighting poverty, and yet, depending on where these people come from, we're importing poverty. We claim to be fighting school failure, and yet, depending on where these people come from, we will be importing people who are very likely to drop out of school. All of this is very closely associated with the general level of intelligence of the populations that we are considering bringing to the United States. So to deny race, to deny the sociological aspects of race and the connection of racial differences between desirable and undesirable social outcomes, is to condemn us to a kind of blindness that makes it impossible for us to decide whom should we welcome and whom should we not. Finally, I said there were two aspects of race that are essentially taboo. One, the scientific, and the other, the sociological. I'll be a little bit more brief on the sociological. That is the fact that although the current myth in the United States is that we are building a society in which race can be made not to matter, it very clearly does matter. Race is an important, even a central aspect of individual and group identity. When there is violence in the prisons, it's not the Baptist prisoners beating up the Methodist prisoners. No, we have race riots in prisons. When there's violence in the schools, it's in fact not the kids whose fathers are poor beating up the kids whose fathers are rich. No. Once again, the divisions, the serious fault lines are racial. Race is a real aspect of practically everyone's identity. As a consequence, those nations in which there is increasing mixture of people who are diverse, people who are different in religion, different in race, different in language, there is increasing friction in a society because people generally wish to spend their time with people like themselves. In the United States today, of course, we are legally obliged to work in an integrated workplace. We are legally obliged never to make any overt decisions on the basis of race, but when people are free to sort themselves out strictly according to their own preferences, whether it's to go to a church, whether it's to invite people to a backyard barbecue, whether it's just to hang out with people that you feel comfortable with, it's amazing the extent to which people sort themselves out on the basis of race. Now, in fact, when you look around the world, it is those places where people are slitting each other's throats most diligently that you find diversity of the kind we are supposed to be celebrating. Diversity of race, religion, language, etc. When people who are different from each other are trying to live in the same territory, that is where you get the worst and most intractable violence, the most persistent problems our species faces. As a consequence, when we talk about how diversity is our strength, and when you even push a little further, some people claim diversity is our greatest strength. It seems to me this is something so wrong and so stupid that only very intelligent people could possibly persuade themselves that it was true. Now, this is a club that likes to talk about politics. And I think it's a legitimate question to ask, well, okay, maybe what you say is right. Maybe even 25 or 50% of what you say is right. But a politician can never say these things. We have to work our way around unpleasant truths. So I think it'd be interesting to imagine whether, say, Congressman Tom Tancredo's impact and influence would increase or decrease or move sideways if he were to give remarks similar to those I've just given. I think there's no question that he would be castigated by the press, but let's not forget that there's not a single newspaper in the United States that has a vote. And I don't doubt that there are people from across the country who would be absolutely delighted to hear an American politician talk honestly about the subject of race. I think it was H.L. Mencken, was it not, who said that we have only one native criminal class in America. It's politicians. Frankly, I would say to you that the crime of which they are most frequently guilty is the crime of boring us. I think there are few things more boring than listening to serious politicians in America today. I would love to hear one say something unpredictable. I'd love to hear one say something controversial, even well-phrased. That would be unpredictable. And I think that in the United States, well, if we look at different political movements, did Lenin conceal what he really thought before he took power? Did Mao Zedong? Did Ayatollah Khomeini? I think the idea that somehow we must conceal the truth from the American people because they're just not grown up enough to take it, I think that's insulting. I think that, in fact, a politician in the United States today might not be punished at the ballot box. I think he'd be well rewarded for speaking honestly about the things that not only liberals, but conservatives refuse to discuss. Thanks very much.